Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works. And today, Michael, we have the privilege of talking to Norman Eisen. Norm has a distinguished career in politics, working for the Obama White House and then serving as ambassador to the Czech Republic. And he is the author of a really interesting book called The Last Palace, Europe's Turbulent Century in Five Lives and One Legendary House.
And probably better known to, or also well known to many Americans as a CNN contributor, mm-hmm. and often on TV and in the media because of his leadership of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Norm Eisen was in charge of ethics with the Obama White House.
That's called the Ethics Czar. Yeah.
And has been quite outspoken in terms of ethics issues with the current administration.
Yeah, and so it's surprising to see this book because it really is a very personal and a very historical accounting of the place where the U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic lives. It's called the Petček Palace, and he really talks about that residence from the time it's constructed at the end of the World War I until now, and just all the history that it's lived through, that it's seen in its walls, and it's in some ways it's not at all what you expect, and yet at the same time it really is kind of a metaphor for Eisen's view about democracy and about the world we're living in today.
Well, it's a story about liberal democracy, mm-hmm. told through the Czech Republic,
right.
and told through the people that have occupied that house. And it's not hard for me to see how Norm Eisen's concerns about ethics and corruption in government tie in with his love for liberal democracy.
Right.
It begins with him telling his mother that he's going to be the next ambassador to the Czech Republic. And of course, his mother, when she was in the then Czechoslovakia, was sent to Auschwitz.
Right.
And survived.
Right.
But it's really quite a story.
And throughout the book, his mother appears as kind of the pessimistic yin to his optimistic yang. And so they have these very interesting and very lovely conversations to, you know, to kind
of... Well, that's like us. I'm the optimist and you're the pessimist.
So there's this long history of Norm Eisen as a political figure, as a writer, and as an advocate for ethics.
So Norm Eisen right now is in the news quite a bit himself, not only as a spokesperson, but because he's leading a lawsuit against, I guess, Donald Trump and his family. I'm not exactly sure how it's, it'd have to be against Donald Trump, about the Emoluments Clause.
And so can you say something about that? It's a very archaic word.
Yeah, well, frankly, before the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., in Mar-a-Lago, I don't think anybody even knew what the Emoluments Clause was.
Well, it's never come up.
Basically, it prohibits the federal government from granting titles of nobility and restricts members of the government from receiving gifts, emoluments, offices, or titles from foreign states without the consent of Congress. So essentially what it does is to say that anybody working within government can't make a profit from foreign government.
Or even,
while they're in office.
Or even entanglements such that would allow for the possibility of corruption, or to allow for the appearance.
Well, that
of,
I think was a lot of what the framers had in mind.
I think
actually,
so.
Is that
yeah.
they thought this would in effect prevent even the appearance of a conflict of interest.
Right.
And they were concerned about the ideas of conflicts of interest. It's important in a democracy that when you elect somebody, you know that they're working for you and not in order to profit themselves.
Right.
A topic I'm sure Jenna will get to in the interview. So maybe now is actually a good time to turn to Jenna and her interview with Norm Eisen. Jenna?
So this is Jenna Spinelli here today with Norm Eisen. Norm, thank you for joining us on Democracy Works.
Jenna, I'm so delighted to be with you and your co-hosts.
So, you know, there are a lot of things that could have been written, given your background in ethics and corruption, and some of the work that you've done. Certainly, no shortage of things to write about in those areas these days. I'm curious to start. Why did you want to tell the story that you tell in The Last Palace about the ambassador's residence?
I suppose that there were multiple objectives in wanting to tell that story. The first was that when I was ambassador in Prague, even before I got to Prague, when I was a nominee, I heard so many incredible tales about the legendary ambassadorial residence, one of the nicest in the world, the Villa Petchek. I continued to collect those stories even when I was there. And so I thought people would enjoy them. That was at a human level, and the people who preceded me. But I also came to believe that there was a larger story that was being told, not just about these people or this house, but the story of democracy over the past 100 years since Wilson helped Europe end World War I and set up the idea of democracy that has come to dominate the globe in this century, together with his European partners. So I wanted to tell that story as well. So it's really the story of five people, an incredible house, and of the transatlantic democracy itself in the past 100 years.
Yeah, and to that point on democracy, there is a quote on the back of the book that described it as a love letter to liberal democracy. Was that your intention going?
Well, I have to admit that I didn't realize the tale of democracy that would emerge with quite the bold, highlighted font when I started researching the stories of these people. But boy, it sure jumped out. So certainly by the time I sealed and mailed the manuscript, yes, I intended it to be a love letter to democracy.
And so you also talk in the book about kind of cycles of democracy that have kind of ebbed and flowed over time. I'm curious where you think we are in one of those cycles today.
We're at an inflection point. There have been three great, on both sides of the Atlantic, three great surges of democracy in the past century. One was the post-World War I, 1918 boom that included the founding of the League of Nations, the founding of the country of Czechoslovakia, where the book is set, later to evolve into the Czech Republic. The second big boom was after World War II, when the modern security structure of NATO was established, securing Western Europe, setting up the Transatlantic Alliance, formally binding the United States by treaty obligations to defend Western Europe and vice versa. And the third was the post-Cold War, post-1989 era, and that was when these ideas swept through Central and Eastern Europe, and even, we hoped, into Russia. Of course, the mistake that we made was more like the post-1918 generation and less like the Marshall Plan that helped a secure democracy in the West after World War II. We didn't do a Marshall Plan for Central and Eastern Europe. We did some transitional help. And then the United States looked away. And one of the tales of this century is when the United States looks away, trouble brews. And that's where we are now, in the form of Mr. Putin leading an illiberal counterattack across Europe. And it's even hit our shores in the form of his and Russia's assault on our democracy in 2016. It's given us his partner, Donald Trump.
Sure. So your book kind of tells the story of the diplomats and the ambassadors who have lived in the Petchek Palace. What can we take from them? What lessons can we learn from their experiences about to kind of deal with where we are today?
One lesson is that democracy has endured far greater challenges, triumphed against far larger obstacles than we face today. So there is somewhat of a lesson of perspective and of optimism. But a second important takeaway is that we can't assume that that will happen on its own. That if you study the ups and downs of the past 100 years, it makes all the difference when the friends of democracy fight for democracy. And so each one of my characters, even the German Wehrmacht general, whose history I recount, in their own way fought for democracy. I write about the way that this general, Toussaint was his name, tried to make common cause with Patton at the end of the war and turned on the SS. I argue he was transformed by living in this magnificent house that exemplifies, was intended to be a tribute to democracy. So we all need to try to fight that good fight if we want democracy to succeed.
Sure. And so coming back to something you said earlier about we have overcome greater challenges than the one that we are currently facing in our democracy. But I'm wondering if our ability to combat the challenge today is perhaps in somehow weaker. We don't have quite the capacity that maybe previous generations did to, you know, fight back against these forces pushing against democracy, given polarization and the lack of shared understanding of information and fragmented news media, those sorts of things.
Well, I think all of those same tools also give us more capacity to fight for democracy. In the dark days after Trump took office, when he launched the patently unconstitutional Muslim ban, when he was accepting foreign government payments in violation of the prohibition on them in the Constitution, they're called emoluments, when he was engaged in so much other misconduct. Those same social media tools that proved so devastating in the 2016 election, so, as you say, so fragmenting, so polarizing, served as a vehicle to bring people together. Hopefully, we're seeing some accountability and oversight returning to at least one House of Congress after the midterms. It's not a partisan statement. It's a desire to have those of whatever party who are willing to do what Congress has not done, true oversight. I think people will look back and say, well, this polarization was overcome by a sense of cohesion using those same tools. So I don't think our situation, our polarization is no worse than it was after the Civil War. It's less bad. We need to use the tools that we have to address it.
Switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about the role that ambassadors play more broadly. We talk a lot about this show, about on this show, about people who are out there doing the hard work of democracy. And it strikes me that ambassadors would certainly fit into that group doing that work on an international scale. But as I'm sure you are well aware, that the Trump administration has scores of ambassador positions around the world that are currently unfilled. What's the impact of that on that kind of, you know, work of democracy that ambassadors do?
It is a problem that this administration has been so disorganized and incompetent that they have not even sent names up for many of the most important and sensitive ambassadorships around the world. And that does cause a democracy deficit, because I know this from doing it myself, it's not always the big things that an ambassador does, but the day in and day out work that having a chief of mission who's been confirmed by the Senate can perform in foreign capitals all over the planet is so important to spreading democracy. Being there to speak up for our Western, this Wilsonian idea of post-1918 that America has so vigorously advanced through three wars, I would contend, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. Partnering with like-minded individuals, working with civil society, defending minorities, free speech, free enterprise, all of the freedoms that constitute the liberal democratic project. You need ambassadors to do that in our capitals around the world, and the gap that Trump has left creates a democracy gap as well.
What do you see as the kind of relationship between authoritarianism and corruption, and how does that impact democracy?
It is a problem that authoritarians, including our own president, always seem as part of their mix of illiberal, of anti-democratic behaviors to try to get a hold of the public's purse and to take a little extra for themselves personally. And we've seen that with Mr. Putin, who some say has become the world's richest man through his corruption. And we've seen it with others. Viktor Orban, for example, is crony capitalism in Hungary. And we've seen it with President Trump, who has himself tried to benefit, and his family and those around him benefiting. That is a sign of autocracy and not a good thing.
Right. Yeah. And can you talk a little bit more about what that work looks like?
I think that our legal system is doing a good job of of keeping up. Look, you do, you know, we're doing the first ever in the history of America a case in which a judge has found that there's a cause of action under the Constitution for accepting these forbidden government cash and other benefits. That's in one of these emoluments cases in Maryland. Of course, when a judge is making a decision for the first time in history, it's going to take a while. It took us over a year to get here. But, you know, that's in order. That there's been a lot of press coverage of that. That has, in turn, helped set a climate where the public and others have kept an eye on these issues. So the big example of this, though, is the Mueller investigation. Has also taken over a year, extraordinary results with guilty pleas and charges. Over 191 counts have been pled, significant guilty pleas by the president's former campaign chair, Mr. Manafort, his former national security advisor, General Flynn. And now reports that the special counsel is going to issue his findings on whether the president obstructed justice. I think there's substantial evidence of that. So and people have paid attention to that. And I think that's a part of the public hesitation about Mr. Trump, his historically low approval ratings. He's said to be very frustrated about that, but he only has himself to blame. So I think the rule of law system is working as it should. And, you know, we need to be a little patient with it.
To bring things back around to the book, I think it's clear from reading it that you have an optimistic point of view while your mother maybe has a more pessimistic view of things.
Indeed.
Do you think that democracy functions better when both of those points of view are represented?
They're not necessarily incompatible. One needs to be acutely aware of the challenges to democracy. If I would argue, if we'd been a little more pessimistic, I'm a congenital optimist like you, but perhaps if we'd been a little more pessimistic, we would have invested better and done a Marshall Plan for Central and Eastern Europe after the end of the Cold War. So there's a role for seeing the challenges. But then we have to, at the same time, honestly look at the fact that we've overcome far more profound difficulties in transatlantic democracy over the past century. And we have to take that strength of democracy into account, too. So it all fits in a nuanced view. And I try to fairly present both sides of the debate. Is the glass half full? Is the glass half empty? The yin and the yang. I try to lay that out in The Last Palace.
Yeah, no, we did a democracy summer reading list episode of this show back in July. And we, and in the span of about 2 weeks, we read about 10 books on democracy, and they all started to run together after a while. So you're putting in a breath of fresh air for all of us.
I tried to do something. I was aware of those, you know. I started on my, and some of those are wonderful books. I read them all. I have to in my profession, many written by friends of mine. But I started writing a similar book over 4 years ago. And, you know, even before the others had come out, I thought, well, why don't I try to do this in a different way with a little bit more of a human touch? So my ambition was to take a different tack, and I'm glad to know you enjoyed it.
Great. So I have one final question here. I know we're coming up on our time to kind of bring things all back around to corruption. Can you just expand a little bit more on why it's bad for democracy?
Well, the idea of democracy includes in it a package of freedoms. Of course, most well known of those is political freedom, that one person, one vote. But there are a set of other freedoms, and corruption impinges both on political freedoms and all of the other ones in the package that we call liberal democracy. You can see in America the way that, this has worked, where campaign contributions, of course, the wealthy corporations enabled by the Citizens United decision, and lobbyists, the special interests have more money to spread around than the average folks. So they have, in the past decades, been able to get more and more power. They give more campaign contributions. They get people elected with the campaign contributions. Then they call in their favors. And sometimes this is legal corruption. It's allowed by the law. That's a big scandal. Sometimes it's illegal corruption. And this system is every year. There is another story about a lobbyist who violated campaign finance law, or a big donor who gave an illegal contribution to a political official. Often there's many stories like that in any given year. So the payback for those forms of legal and illegal corruption is a system that takes more and more wealth away from an effort towards equal or a fair distribution, including equality of opportunity. And then, like the Trump tax plan, gives disproportionate benefits to the donors, to the super rich who are paying illegal or legal bribes to their favored candidates. It happens in both parties. There's been some asymmetry. It's happened more with the Republicans, in my view. And that's why you see things like this terrible Trump GOP tax plan, which is accelerating our deficits, giving gross excess to the super rich and starving the rest of us. So that's an example. I could go on and on. I probably got on too long. But that's an example of one of the ways that corruption corrodes democracy.
Well, maybe we can have you back on and take a deeper dive into corruption sometime. But for now, thank you for your time today, for the work that you're doing, and for this great book, which we'll make sure to link to in our show notes.
Thank you. Thank you for your marvelous podcast and for those wonderful questions. And I look forward to coming back on and filibustering some more. And when I join you again, I've described the problem of corruption. Maybe we'll talk about some of the solutions too, because they are coming.
Yeah, we would welcome that. So thank you again, Norm, for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
All right. So recently, we have spent a lot of time talking on this podcast about authors and about issues that quite rightly are pretty negative.
And then a whole book review show.
Yes, right. And just about every one of them bespoke this feeling of dread, right? But here is a man who knows just as much as any of those authors about why there is good reason to be negative about the condition of our world today and pessimistic about the future of democracy. And yet he is and calls himself an eternal optimist. And I think it is worth reflecting. I mean, first of all, the man has standing to have whatever point of view he wants. And in this case, I often think it is a point of view that is respectable and worth our consideration.
Well, and it speaks to the importance of having a long historical view of things.
That's right.
That things have been worse.
Mm-hmm.
And we can point to lots worse examples. America was more polarized. The world has been more violent. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things to point to that if you look at things in that perspective, we're in an important period. But
there's reason to be optimistic. And I would say that one of the things he points to, and you hear this from others too, and this has been an interest in McCourt and some of the polling it's done as well, is that the courts are holding.
Mm-hmm.
And that so long as the courts as an institution are there, play their role, protect democracy, then we're okay.
Well, yeah.
Or at least that we don't need to quite worry so much.
Well, I mean, I think he is – I've heard him say that, you know, the proper way to understand democracy is that it's always going to be something of a sine wave, right? There's always going to be peaks and valleys, and there's always going to be reactions from illiberal, undemocratic elements within, you know, within every society and within human beings. And so once you know that to be so, once you understand that those things are always going to be there, it gives you a perspective with not only with respect to the present day, but also with respect to what our task is, right? That we're always kind of called on to defend these dimensions of a democratic society.
Right. And he says, so long as there are friends of democracy willing to fight for it, then democracy will be okay.
Right. Well, or at least, look, I mean,
maybe that's overstating it
a little
bit, but that it's important that there are people, organizations, institutions that are fighting for democracy.
But I also think you're right in the sense that he believes that there is something about democracy that makes it endure, that causes it to endure. And I think that is also something that I think we need to reflect on. I mean, his argument is that democracy endures because democracy is good and right and morally superior to other forms of government. You know, free exercise, free expression, protection of minorities. These are not just different ways of organizing society. They're better ways. They're more human ways. And I think sometimes we lose track of that sense that, you know, what we are defending here is it's just better. It's worth defending. It's worth sticking up for.
Yes, but.
Okay. All right. remember, folks, he's the optimist.
There were some things he said that gave me pause. You know, one is how easily he's able to talk about, and when Jenna asked him about corruption, to talk about our president in the same context of other authoritarian leaders pursuing basically the same strategy.
I think that's right. But you just said that the courts are holding, and the courts are the proper mechanism for addressing this question. And, you know, as he says, it's not going to happen, not going to turn on a dime.
The other thing that gives me pause in what he was saying was when he was talking about how, well, we've been in these situations before, we come out of it, we've been polarized before, like the Civil War, we were highly polarized. But then he also mentioned that social media, you know, is perhaps a tool. But we also know that social media has been really destructive to our democracy in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
that's not going away.
That's not going away. But I think I'm reflecting back on what Matt Jordan said when he was on the podcast.
Well, I'm also thinking about what Laura Rosenberger had to say about how authoritarian governments are using social media to fragment our democracy.
No doubt about it. But Matt Jordan's perspective, like Norm Eisen's, was more historical. And his point was that, you know, technology creates these new forms of media, and it takes a while for democratic society to learn how to adapt to them, to take them into themselves, and take it into democratic society. And, you know, is this going to be the one time where it doesn't do that? Man, I suppose that's possible. But it's also quite possible that, like radio, like penny dailies, like television, like cable news, eventually, democratic society will catch up, and democratic society will endure.
So it was really quite interesting, and that was in response to Jenna's question about ambassadors, because the reality is we do have many unfilled ambassadorships. It's not because the Senate's not fulfilling them. It's, as Norm said, that no names have been sent up, and I think it's problematic that we don't have ambassadors in many places.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And
that is right.
And this really does infringe upon our ability to communicate to these governments what's important to the United States, and to have the kind of channels that are set up through an ambassador in a country.
And what Norm would say is that, you know, the ambassador is an indispensable means by which United States preserves this Wilsonian ideal about democracy and about defending the institutions and the values that are, you know, commensurate with that.
And that was, you know, under many administrations, that was a top priority in the United States to promote democracy in some form or another, at least to be speaking out against clear violations of democratic norms in other countries.
Right.
And how foreign policy is being conducted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And at minimum, the one of the essential means by which democracy is defended throughout the world is left empty, and that's not good for democracy.
Yes, and maybe we should leave it right there.
So kudos to Norm for this book and for his life spent defending democracy.
Yes, and thanks to Jennifer, a nice interview with him.
As usual.
Interesting, yep.
All right.
This has been Democracy Works.
I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Michael Berkman from the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.